This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. 100 years ago this week, Massachusetts became the first state in the country to adopt a minimum wage. Exact date? June 4th, 1912.
The national minimum wage wouldn't come until 1938. But a generation earlier, a Massachusetts commission declared, quote, "Wherever the wages of such a woman are less than the cost of living and the reasonable provision for maintaining the worker in health, the industry employing her is in receipt of the working energy of a human being at less than its cost, and to that extent is parasitic."
So why here, and why then, and what's happened to the politics and policy of the minimum wage since 1912? We'll hear in a moment from a scholar of the modern-day minimum wage and the economy and economics surrounding it. But first, we'll begin with the history. Robert Ferrant is a professor of history and regional economic and social development at UMass Lowell. He's here with us now. Professor Ferrant, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Pleasure to be here.
So take us back into time to 1912. The first thing that stands out to me when I hear what the commission wrote in Massachusetts is the use of the feminine pronoun.
They were upset in many ways because we had just seen from the beginning of 1912 a series of what turned out to be incredibly powerful textile strikes across Massachusetts, across New England, the Bread and Roses strike probably being the most famous. Those were largely women workers, and people got very sort of frightened of the possibilities of workers organizing. So that's juxtaposed against the idea that in places like Massachusetts, there's this incredible growth of this highly educated population. They're scared to death of the possibilities of class warfare.
Mm, we're talking women and children,
women in
fact.
Children, right.
What was the, I guess if you could call it, average wage of a female textile worker at the time?
About 11 cents an hour.
Which would mean today?
About $2.10 today. You can generally multiply by about 20 what a wage was back then to figure out what it would be comparable to in purchasing power today. So $2.20 an hour.
So you were saying something interesting about the fact that there's this fear amongst the upper classes of class warfare arising from the working class of Massachusetts. But that commission uses very powerful language saying that basically industry is taking human capital, human energy, and not returning it in a wage that's fair. Therefore, industry is being parasitic upon its workers. I mean, that's more than just, you know, pay them a minimum wage. There's a sense that Massachusetts as a state wanted to invoke some form of justice in the workplace.
And again, it's really in the context of everything that's been happening. We have just a few months prior to the start of 1912, the Triangle Factory Fire, 146, mostly women immigrants lose their lives in a horrific fire. And so there's this growing awareness that the rapid industrialization that the country has passed through right after the Civil War until the turn into the 20th century has created tremendous wealth, but it's not being equitably distributed. And workers, while they're trying to organize, are really fighting, in many respects, a losing battle. And so absent some intervention on the part of the Commonwealth in this case, or the federal government later on, you know, how's the rock going to be pushed up the hill?
Well, Robert Ferrant, I do wonder, though, we're talking about industry in Massachusetts in 1912, especially the textile mills. They were hugely important to the economy of the state. We're not talking some far-flung, you know, small sector of the economy. What was the response from industry when this move was afoot to institute or to call for some sort of minimum wage across the board?
Industry then reacted the same way that industry now reacts to possibilities of raising the minimum wage. Back then, they said that the government was going to interfere and create some sort of a mechanism that would prevent them from doing business the way they wanted to do it. And so you can hear a lot of the same language then as well as now. And so this was not a happy marriage. I mean, ultimately, this law, as a consequence, is really watered down. And what we really end up getting is a commission gets set up that's supposed to police workplaces and figure out whether, in fact, an employer is being parasitic. If, in fact, an employer is being parasitic, using the Commonwealth's words, towards its women workers, The only penalty is their name will be put in the newspapers in the state of Massachusetts, sort of like the scarlet letter of employers, and saying, okay, you're not treating your workers properly. But there's really no mechanism in the Massachusetts law to say you must pay this amount of money per hour.
So there was no effective minimum wage that was set in.
No, there was shame and guilt, and there was the commission, which was supposed to study and determine whether, in fact, what people were being paid was something sufficient for them to maintain themselves and live a decent life. And so if they arrived at that conclusion, this three-person commission, if they arrived at that conclusion, then a bigger commission of 13, at least 13 people, six industry people, six people representing the workers, and one disinterested party, as the law read, and then other people, should they add more to it, would then try to figure out what the wage ought to be. And they would have to agree, two-thirds of this bigger bureaucratic entity, what the wage ought to be. But then again, it wasn't like it is today. In your break room, there's on your wall what the minimum wage is and what the federal minimum wage is and what the Massachusetts minimum wage is. That didn't exist.
Okay. So actually, that brings me to the point that I wanted to get to, which is, as of right now, the minimum wage in Massachusetts is $8 an hour, which is slightly higher than the federal minimum wage. I guess, briefly, overall, when there was the Minimum Wage Act of 1938 that really instituted a national minimum wage. And since then, do you have a sense as to how having this floor in terms of what a worker can be paid, what effect that has had in Massachusetts?
I mean, it fluctuates up and down, as one would suspect, with the economy. And so when the economy is doing well, the economy is expanding, more and more jobs are being added, there's sort of an effect that all boats will rise. Most of the literature that I look at suggests that if the minimum wage goes up, other wages will go up as well. There's that sort of effect that if the bottom sort of goes up, all boats will rise, if you sort of get that visual. The same way with when unions are around and union wages go up, other wages in an area where there's a union effect, the wages will go up as well. But the fact remains that the Massachusetts minimum wage, though it's $8, it's 75 cents higher than the federal one, it still isn't enough to sort of get to the level that the Health and Human Services says is needed for a family of four, mm-hmm. To just be at the, you know, above a bit the poverty level. So there's still it's better than nothing. And I guess the way I look at the history of labor and employers don't generally sort of give benefits just out of the goodness of their heart. There's always going to be a push and a pull. And so the law does do something to that extent.
Listeners, we're talking about the minimum wage and the fact that the first blushes of it appeared here in Massachusetts 100 years ago this week. So do you work at the minimum wage? Are you one of those employees in Massachusetts who pulls in $8 an hour? And what is life like for you at the minimum wage? Is it enough? Is it adequate? And if you're an employer or a business owner and you're here in Massachusetts or anywhere listening to this, do you think the minimum wage is something that helps you do business? Is it something that prevents you from hiring employees? What's your overall take in terms of the policy and impact a minimum wage has here in Massachusetts and across the United States? Has it done what it was intended to do, and that being, in the original Massachusetts language of 1912, prevent businesses from being, quote, parasitic on their workers? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. I'm joined in the studio by Professor Robert Ferrant. He is a professor of history and regional economic and social development at UMass Lowell. Joining us now also is Professor David Newmark. He is a professor of economics at the University of California at Irvine and author of Minimum Wages. He joins us today on the line because he's in a conference in Spain. Professor Newmark, welcome to Radio Boston.
How are you? Thanks for having me on.
It's a real pleasure to have you on. We started this conversation back in 1912 and looking at sort of what Massachusetts was like then and why it might have thought about bringing about a minimum wage. But let me ask you today, I guess I want to start with the big picture with you. Do you think that overall having a minimum wage across the United States is beneficial or detrimental to the economy as a whole?
I'd break that into two pieces. Relative to the economy as a whole, how is the macroeconomy doing? Are we going to get out of the Great Recession soon? the minimum wage is sort of irrelevant, right? It affects a small proportion of workers. Anyone who says aggregate unemployment is higher because of the minimum wage or isn't higher is really barking up the wrong tree. So for the economy as a whole, I think it's kind of needle in a haystack or even less than that. I think the right question is, does the minimum wage help the people it's supposed to affect? That is low wage, low skilled workers. And I think the answer on that question is it doesn't really help them on net. There's lots and lots of evidence on the employment effects of minimum wages. There's some study to the contrary, as there often are, but the overwhelming amount of evidence says minimum wages do create some job loss.
Now is that in the short run or the long run? That's the thing that I couldn't really suss out in studying and looking at all these studies today.
It tends not to be a persistent effect, because what we do in the U.S. and in most states, a few states have changed, is we periodically and somewhat unsystematically raise the minimum wage to some level, $8 in Massachusetts now, and then at some point, maybe a few years from now, legislators, governor, president, whatever, get together and raise it again. So we don't index it, in other words. A few states do and many other countries do. So typically what happens is the minimum wage goes up by a small amount, 50 cents, 75 cents, a dollar, and then there's a little bit of wage inflation, so that minimum wage gets eroded. So the effects are never really persistent. It's kind of in the 1 or 2 years after a minimum wage increase occurs, and after that, it's usually fairly irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
I would say Professor Perron is right. Businesses always jump up and down and scream about minimum wages, going to put us out of business. I mean, that's clearly hyperbole and overreaction. I don't know if anyone's ever been put out of business by the minimum wage. The way I think about it, and the research kind of follows this course, is there is some job loss from the minimum wage. That in and of itself doesn't mean it's a bad idea. I could pick almost any environmental regulation, any workplace safety and health regulation. It does probably cost somebody a job somewhere. When we don't allow drilling somewhere, right? There's fewer drilling jobs in Alaska. And as public policy advisors, which is what we often serve in, we have to think about the trade-offs. Is there something we're getting for this cost?
Well, David Newmark, I was just going to ask you about that, because you did say something a little earlier that sort of teased this line of thinking, and that is that you said when it comes to what we get out of it, you seem to say that the exact people who are earning low income are the ones who are actually getting the least out of it because of the potential negative impacts of having or even increasing a minimum wage. I was wondering if you could tell us in a little bit more detail what you meant by that.
Sure. I think what happens, and the data bears this out, is when the minimum wage goes up, there's winners and there's losers, right? There are people who don't lose their jobs, and that's obviously most of the people affected, who don't have their hours reduced, and they earn a higher wage, so they have more income. There are some people who lose their jobs, a small number, but of course the loss of income is pretty big. Some people who have hours reduced. So there's winners and losers, and the question is, kind of how does that shake out in the income distribution? Once you kind of add up the wins and losses and ask where people are in the family income distribution, are they in poor families or not? The answer suggests that it's kind of a wash. Some people are helped, some are not helped. On average, if you look across states, when minimum wages go up, poverty rates certainly don't decline. There's sometimes a hint of evidence that they even go up. And I should say, going back in history, it was a very different story. When the minimum wage, I don't know the Massachusetts history back to 1912, but I know the federal history starting in 1938, it used to be the case that being a low-wage worker was very highly correlated with being in a poor family, right? And that's partly because back in 1938, when we passed the federal minimum wage, there wasn't much else to support poor people, right? If you worked, no matter what. Now we have a more generous safety net. A lot of poor families have no workers. And conversely, a lot of minimum wage workers back then were actually heads of household, whereas now a lot of minimum wages are secondary workers, teenagers, another worker in a family. In some sense, the disconnect between low wage work, which is what minimum wages target, and low income families has gotten increasingly strong over time. I'll just give you two numbers now.
Hold that thought for just a second, because I do want to bring Robert Ferrant back in exactly on this point. I mean, do you find that to be true here in Massachusetts? Who is working at the minimum wage in this state, at least, right now?
About 1 in 5 workers in Massachusetts, so roughly about 25% of workers in the Commonwealth right now, are making between $8 and $11 an hour. And $11 an hour, if you'd work 2,000 hours in a year, gets you to about 21,000, something like that. I'm a historian, not a mathematician. But thanks. So, and about 63% of those workers are over 20. And what I found looking at
They're not teenagers with summer jobs.
No, they're not teenagers. And 58% of those are women, and most of them are single women heads of households. So they're what I guess we would call the working poor. And so, there are people that might be working at a place like Walmart, and so they're not making enough money, and they don't have health insurance. So they're working working close to, if not full-time. But they're working at a wage that's not going to get them up and out of poverty. And so the structural problem still, is there.
Well, David Newmark, I mean, I know you were talking about these numbers at a national level, but here you hear Robert Ferrant giving us a glimpse of what's happening here in Massachusetts. It sounds like a lot of people at that minimum wage, working at that minimum wage, are exactly what you were talking about. They are heads of households. They are pulling in most of the income.
There are certainly minimum wage workers who are heads of household. To say, and I don't know the exact numbers we're discussing here, I can give you some of my own, but from the CPS data, which is what most of us use, to say 60% are not teenagers, there aren't that many teenagers. So 40% are teenagers. That's a lot of teenagers relative to the workforce. I put it this way. If you look, this is from research by Richard Burkhauser and Joseph Sevilla. They look at 1939, a year after the federal minimum wage was first passed, right? At that point, 85% of low-wage workers, that's people making less than half the private sector wage, the average private sector wage, 85% were in poor families, right? In the last couple decades, it's about 15%, right? So, yes, there are poor heads of household who earn the minimum wage, that's why they're poor, of course. But if you look at minimum wage workers, and I don't think Massachusetts is different from the rest of the country, there's a lot of them are non-poor families. I mean, there are labor economists who agree with my take on minimum wages. There are some who don't. Across the board, the labor economists will agree, because this is incontrovertible based on the data, minimum wages target poor families really badly. The law doesn't target poor families, right? Currently, about a third of minimum wage workers are in the top half of the income distribution.
The top 50%. Okay, but that's a huge distribution, though, when you say the top half, though.
That's over 50,000, roughly.
Okay. Well, I want to take a couple calls. I'm sorry to have interrupted you there, Professor Newmark, but we do have some listeners on the line who want to join us. We're talking about 100 years of the minimum wage. It got its start here in Massachusetts in 1912. I'm joined by Professor David Newmark from the University of California at Irvine. He joins us today from a conference in Spain where one could think they're having their own income problems there. And Professor Robert Ferrant, he's a professor of history and regional economic and social development at UMass Lowell. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Let's go to Andover, where Sam is calling. You're on the air, Sam.
Hi, I'm Sam. I'm 19 years old, and I currently have a job paying $9 an hour. I work 6 days a week, 10 hours a day, so I'm getting paid overtime. But despite that, I still feel that the minimum wage and wages typically through teenagers and a lot of other people in the workforce in this sector of wage line aren't getting compensated for the lifestyles that they have to live beyond the workforce. I mean, I go to college, and with loans increasing and just all of my debt piling up, I just don't feel like I have the opportunities to make as much money during my summers as I should, given the fact that the minimum wage is still, I think, at a persistently low level.
Sam, thank you so much for your call. Robert Ferrant, let's start with you. Your response to him.
Well, I see this all the time with students that sit in front of me, and this is this other question of debt piling up for people as they hit their early 20s to mid-20s. And, I mean, the other sort of pernicious aspect to this is actually the no-wage job, the internship that pays nothing, right? And so I sympathize with the caller. This is really a huge problem. And I mean, it's hard to try to figure out what we do with this. Again, in terms of the caller sort of sets up one example, but then you also have, as the Massachusetts data suggests, lots of workers, for example, working in nursing homes, home health care, home child care, things like that, making the minimum or maybe a quarter over the minimum and trying to raise a family as well. So if the caller is having difficulties as a single person, what happens to these people and families?
Let's take another caller. Chris is calling from Sherburn. You're on the air, Chris.
Yeah, hi there. One thing that strikes me is that effectively there is no minimum wage anymore, at least in the major manufacturing industry. Perhaps there is in local service industries, because virtually any job can be shipped out overseas. And strangely enough, the prices and everything still keep going up. We're stuck in a really funny mind.
Chris, thank you so much for your call. David Newmark, your response to that.
Well, I mean, there is a minimum wage because there is a legal floor and there's not that much violation of it. It is true that some jobs move overseas, but I think that's a whole other issue for a whole other show.
Right? Well, I mean, let's touch upon it in a little bit, if we can, in just a couple seconds.
Sure.
Because he was talking about specifically, for example, in manufacturing, and that's a perfect example of how we've seen that while, yes, there is a minimum wage due to globalization.
But
because
in manufacturing, most workers earn way above the minimum wage still.
Okay.
Minimum wage is not very binding in the manufacturing industry. It's much more, as Professor Ferrand suggested, sort of low wage service sectors where this is really in retail, home health, you know, kind of less skilled home health care workers and the like, daycare workers, where this is much more relevant.
Well, on that point,
those jobs fortunately can't be outsourced.
Let me ask you, in the last couple minutes that we have, you and Professor Ferrand, about this idea that, you know, if you said a little earlier that overall a minimum wage is a wash in terms of its effect on unemployment and its overall effect on the economy, then does that not bring us back around to sort of the philosophical drive behind why, you know, we saw in 1912 in Massachusetts a movement to establish some sort of minimum wage, that it just makes sort of common sense as a nation that we want to put a minimum standard for how we value the work that individuals do? And is that not reason enough to have a minimum wage not only persist, but perhaps keep up, for example, with inflation, which it has not done in decades?
I think there's two points you made, and they don't necessarily connect. You don't necessarily connect the dots. Should a rich society like ours decide that there's a minimum standard of living that we're willing to accept? The answer is clear. I don't think anyone disagrees. The answer is yes. You know, different countries, we do it differently from Europe, of course, where it's higher. We do have a minimum standard. We don't necessarily have to do it through the minimum wage, right? We do a lot of things to give people skills, right? School is free through high school. We have an earned income tax credit now, which is a very generous system that targets poor families and low-income families as opposed to low-wage workers, and therefore works much better. And we have other kinds of government benefits that poor people and other low-income people get. So I think there's two separate issues. Should we have a standard, and what should it be? One could easily argue the U.S. is too low. We tend to be lower relative to other Western countries. The second is the minimum wage a good way to do it? And I would suggest not really.
Hmm. Robert Ferrand, last thought goes to you. We've just got a couple of minutes to go here.
And yet we still have the situation we're faced with today with high foreclosures, with the budget cuts essentially being balanced on taking away parts and pieces of that safety net of making public education grovel for dollars with higher education, public, the state education systems that both of us teach in, struggling for their budget money, and more people, it seems to me, having a really dismal future. So it has to be, I agree, at the end of the day, it can't just be the minimum wage. It has to be a variety of things. And again, I think that we're in this position where employers don't just necessarily step up to the table, and the moral suasion in that original bill and the language that was used in 1912 is really part and parcel, when you think about it, of the Occupy movement and we're the 99% and all those things. It's a similar, you could take from that law in 1912 and put it up on the table today.
Robert Ferrand is a professor of history and regional economic and social development at UMass Lowell. Professor Ferrand, great to see you again. Thanks so much for coming.
Thanks.
And David Newmark is a professor of economics at the University of California at Irvine and author of Minimum Wages. Professor Newmark, pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much. Great conversation.
And listeners, continue this conversation online. Would love to hear what you think about 100 years of the minimum wage and where you'd like to see it go from here. Join us for that online conversation at radioboston.org. Coming up, a new model of in vitro fertilization may help hopeful parents avoid multiple births. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.